want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're in for a treat today. You're going to hear the audio from the local TV show that I co-host here in Marin County, California. And we were visited by Barney Frank this week. Barney retired last year after 42 years in the House of Representatives. And he's peddling a new book, which I recommend, simply called Frank. And yes, that's a play on his surname, but it is a remarkably candid book, where he acknowledges some of his own personal foibles, including a limited attention span, which he says worked to his advantage. He talks about his rise in Boston politics, his entry into the United States Congress in the year when Ronald Reagan came to Washington, and how things have changed. And this is my fifth or sixth encounter with Barney Frank. And now that he's freed from the combat rules of day-to-day politics, I found a kinder, gentler Barney Frank. When you hear me ask the question about Hillary Clinton, of whom he is a staunch supporter, in the past, when I started to raise the 3 points in that question, he would have cut me off after the first one. But he let me ask the whole question. He acknowledged that Hillary is too hawkish even for him. And later, he surprised me in our conversation about the 2008 economic meltdown, and he was at the center of it as chair of the House Banking Committee. And he surprised me by acknowledging that there should have been prosecutions and convictions of Wall Street criminals. So while this is not the hardest-hitting interview I've ever done, I think you'll find it interesting. You'll also get to meet my co-host and partner in cable TV crime, Larry Strick. He's an attorney here in the Bay Area who happens to be my office mate in the building where I'm located. Before we get going, I like to always thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions. Natalie Reel has been a longtime supporter out in Montana. Thank you so much. Deborah Madera just renewed her annual subscription. Thanks, Deborah. And Nick Yaksich and Sally Soriano are longtime monthly subscribers. I invite you to join their ranks. I need your support to keep all this going. You can log in at peterbcollins.com. Click on the sign-up link right under my picture. That takes you to the page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers anywhere within the sound of my voice get a bonus gift. That's the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's Empire of Chaos. So here we go. And by the way, in the opening sequence, we lit a birthday candle for Barney Frank. So that'll explain a little bit of what's going on, because you're only hearing the audio. You can't see the video of this televised interview. Welcome to Marin Voices and Views. With Lawrence A. Strick, I'm Peter B. Collins. Our very special guest today is retired Congressman Barney Frank, who served 42 years in the House of Representatives. He joins us just before an appearance at Dominican University here on the very last day of March, which happens to be his birthday.
Yes, indeed.
Mr. Frank, welcome and happy birthday to you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
We didn't attempt to get enough candles to match your age.
Six.
Yeah. Well,
when Lincoln went to law school. There you go.
Thank you.
Well, happy birthday. I want to make sure you get to a doggy bag.
Thank you.
So you were on a media tour to promote the new book called Frank, A Life in Politics, From the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. And as the title conveys, the book is remarkably frank. And you probably heard that pun maybe 80 times too many.
I welcome it. I'm proud of it.
But you're extremely honest about yourself, including your short attention span, your fast-talking, low enunciation style of speaking, and that you're quick to anger. You talk in detail about more than 30 years in the closet before you came out in 1987. Is it liberating to be able to talk about your inner struggles and how they informed your very public work?
Well, I thought that was more of an obligation. Obviously, I did feel the obligation to come out, and all things considered, I would have preferred not to have been as open about some of those things, but I thought I could make up for the years in which I was hiding my own sexual orientation by sharing the process in a way that I hope will be helpful to other people going through it, particularly younger people. Look, we're making great progress, obviously, in diminishing this prejudice. The fact that the roof fell in on the governor of Indiana for his bigotry, which he says really wasn't, is encouraging. But there are still people out there who face this in parts of the country. So I did think being as honest as I was could be helpful to others.
And you're married now to Jim Reedy.
Reddy. Yes.
Jim Reddy, who's here.
He is with me, yep, and is a great source of strength.
But the marriage issue took a long time to come about. And I was interested to read in your book a little bit about 2004 when Nancy Pelosi contacted you to talk to Gavin Newsom, who was then mayor of San Francisco and was on the brink of going out and was going to be performing marriages pursuant to his authority.
Mock marriages, unfortunately.
Mock marriages, pursuant to what authority he thought he had. And you disagreed with that. Tell us about that.
Well, two things. I'll be honest with you, I doubt that he thought he had the authority. I think he thought it would be a good political gesture. Here is the deal. We had just gotten same-sex marriage for the first time in the country in 2003, thanks to a great decision by the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts. And it was clear to me that the way we were going to get same-sex marriage broadened was if we could establish almost a beachhead. It was almost a military operation. Disprove these arguments that same-sex marriage was corrosive of society, that it undermined heterosexual marriage. Because as soon as we got it, major Republican political figures tried to undo it. George W. Bush as president, Mitt Romney as governor of Massachusetts. Romney tried to get the Massachusetts legislature to undo it. George Bush proposed a national constitutional amendment that would have abolished same-sex marriage even retroactively. And here's where I had my disagreement with Gavin Newsom. I knew I could get many of my colleagues in Congress who were afraid of the politics of same-sex marriage back home to vote with me if they could say, look, we're not going to have same-sex marriage in Maryland or Pennsylvania or Oregon. Massachusetts wants it. Let's let Massachusetts do it. And that was the way we could defeat a national constitutional amendment. But when Gavin Newsom said, oh, by the way, if they have it in Massachusetts, we can have it in California, and we can have it in New York, someone said, and we can have it in New Mexico. And that was without any procedural safeguards. If any mayor anywhere could now announce that he was going to perform same-sex marriages, my colleagues would then be feeling the pressure from back home to step in. And that was the threat. And in fact, Karl Rove picked up on that and started to kind of nationalize the issue.
And how many states did he run ballot measures in that
half
year?
A dozen. They were very important.
16,
yeah, he took advantage of that. Mm-hmm. I'd forgotten that. And he took advantage of that to John Kerry's loss. So that's why Nancy Pelosi asked me to talk to the Mayor Newsom, and I said, please, let's do this in Massachusetts. Once we have demonstrated, as I know we're going to be able to, that these negative arguments are false, we can go forward. Again, I'll use the military analogy, you don't engage on a broad front when you don't have the troops to do that. You concentrate where you're going to win and build from there.
You already referenced Mike Pence and the dust-up in Indiana over this religious freedom law. You served with him. He was a House member for many years, very conservative. What is your insight into why he took this step? Clearly, he's pandering to Christian voters for a presidential run. But what else is at work in Mike Pence?
Well, it's a severe case of cultural lag. And in some ways, this is one of the best things that's happened. Because what I keep saying, I say in the book, progress has always been quicker than I thought. I mean, I started out as a kid figuring I could never be a successful politician because people hated gay people so much. And by the end of my career, being gay was more popular than being a politician. And what Pence forgot, what didn't realize was, no, the country is moving beyond this prejudice. And of course, look, when you are a politician and you have to say something that is ludicrous on its face, when Pence says, this was not meant to allow discrimination, well, that was its sole purpose. When you have to say something that's totally untrue and no one will believe it, you know you're in trouble. So I was encouraged. And by the way, what was encouraging was the business community that spoke up. And these weren't your nuts and berries granola businesses. This is Cummins Diesel. What
right,
could be more
NCAA.
Of a... Yeah, the NCAA, exactly. What could be more mainstream America? Eli Lilly. So he did not realize that the kind of bigotry to which he was appealing was going out of style.
Yeah, but the same thing is going on in like a dozen other states. And why
it's going to collapse. Why did it happen here and
why now? Yeah,
I don't know, but I do know that this is... Well, by the way, it did happen in Arizona a couple years ago when the governor there was persuaded to veto it by John McCain and all the businesses. And sometimes things are going along below the radar and you don't know what's happening, but this one got attention, so I think it's very clear. There'll be very few governors who are going to want to go through what Pence is going through.
Barney Frank, another major thread in your book is that you're a pragmatist. You're willing to accept half a loaf in the legislative process. And I've often heard Nancy Pelosi say, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Could you give us an example or two of cases where liberal activists, in your opinion, were unwilling to compromise and opportunities were lost?
Yes, and it's, you know, Nancy Pelosi was one of the people with whom I was privileged to work most closely. She has been one of our great national leaders. And one was on the case of a bill to outlaw discrimination in employment based on sexual orientation. Now, we did that in 2007, the first year that Nancy Pelosi became Speaker. At the time when we originally filed the bill, Speaker Pelosi, myself, others, wanted to include people who are transgender. Mm-hmm. The problem was that we were not at the point in the public understanding of transgender that we had reached with gay and lesbian people. I first filed an LGB gay rights bill in 1972, and there was a lot of resistance. Over time, people came out, they knew who we were, our reality defeated the prejudice. The transgender movement hadn't gone as far. So we were in a position where we were able to pass a bill in the House to protect people who are lesbian, gay, and bisexual against job discrimination, not yet transgender people. I think that would have been very good. First of all, it would have protected a lot of people who weren't protected before. Secondly, it would have shown that some of this notion that an anti-discrimination bill is disruptive was wrong. And moving from there to include transgender people would have been easier. Well, we weren't going to get that signed by George Bush, but there was such anger on the part of so many in the community that we didn't do it all at once, that when we got a Democratic president and had a Democratic House and Senate, and we would otherwise have been able to pass such a bill, we weren't able to. Hmm. And now it's going to be a long time because the Republicans control the House. And I think passing a bill that did most of what you want and demonstrated that this could be very workable would have been closer to the overall situation than we are today.
I was interested in the beginning of your book when you talk about growing up in New Jersey. Like you, I'm a kid from New Jersey. I'm a Jewish guy. I'm a lawyer like you. I didn't go to Harvard, but that's okay. How did your career take the turn of working for Mayor White in Boston? And in other words, how did a Jewish kid from Jersey get involved in Boston ward politics?
I went up to college, and I wanted to be I campaigned for other people. I liked doing that, and I cared a lot about trying to improve society. And I went to work for Kevin White. I'd taken a year off from teaching. I had no administrative responsibilities. I was able to get by financially just to write a PhD thesis. And he was running in 1967 against a terrible racist, a woman named Louise Day Hicks. And I didn't know him very well, but I knew her very well from her reputation. She was a racist. She was terrible. So I went to work for him. And it turned out, as I've said in the book, I was not doing well with my PhD thesis. But I went to work for him as kind of his general assistant, and he'd be working on this thing, and half hour later he had to work on that thing, and then something totally different. as opposed to a piece of scholarship where you're working on the same thing. And then I realized, you know, if you can analyze yourself and go to where you're good and not where you're weak, go where you're good. And I have one characteristic that was helpful in being the mayor's general assistant and not very good for being a scholar. I have a short attention span. I understand that. And that made me very valuable to the mayor. So he, at the end of the campaign, when he won, said, I'd like you to come work for me. I said, no, I have to go write my PhD thesis. Now, Boston had been very socially conservative at the time, and he was kind of liberal. And he said, look, I know you. You want me to integrate the city in the way it hasn't been before. You want to build housing for low-income people. You want to expand health care. You want to do all these liberal things. It's going to be hard in Boston, given the political culture. So if you walk away and I don't get things done, you got no complaint. Don't come back to me and say you didn't do it. Well,
guilt.
Yeah, I gave up.
Guilt works.
It Barney, does. You explain in the book that you were perhaps the only Democrat to win election on Ed Muskie's coattails.
George McGovern's.
Oh, McGovern, I'm sorry, in 72, right?
72.
Yeah. And then you rode into Washington with the so-called Reagan Revolution.
Yes, I did.
Describe for us the change in tone and the partisanship that has grown virulent since arrived in Washington.
It started, by the way, and it was not that bad under Reagan. Reagan was very conservative, but there was some cooperation. I worked, for example, with a Republican United States Senator, Warren Rudman from New Hampshire, to frustrate a local guy, Ed Meese, who had been DA in Alameda. He hated all mm-hmm. those people at Berkeley. He wanted to do away with the Legal Services Corporation.
Yeah.
And a very good Republican who had been Attorney General of New Hampshire, Warren Rudman, said, no, we don't deny people legal help in America. And we succeeded. And things were going well until Newt Gingrich came on the scene. And Gingrich was very explicit. He said, you know, we Republicans will never take over as long as we treat the Democrats as honorable people with whom we disagree. We must point out that they are corrupt, that they are immoral, that they are treasonous.
And liberalism became a disease in
yeah.
their view.
And he, you know, we didn't take it seriously. And he fought very effectively. He forced out of office the man who had been the minority leader when he got there, a man named Bob Michael. And he really threatened him, and he went to enough other Republicans and said, we got to stop being so nice. You know, Bob Michael shouldn't be a friend of Tip O'Neill's. So he began this move towards more partisanship. That was a problem, but things were still working. Look, when Bill Clinton, even though they tried to impeach him, was able to do some things with the Republicans. And then George Bush and Ted Kennedy collaborated on No Child Left Behind. And then in 2008, when the economy was collapsing, George Bush came to Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and they designated Chris Dodd and myself, and we gave him a great deal of cooperation. But when Barack Obama came in, this movement of the Republican Party that had been going forward just took over. And there was now this, you know, there's always been a tension between the Democrats who believed that the public sector should have a bigger role, the Republicans who believed the private sector should have a bigger role, but each agreed that the other had a legitimate point of view. Now you have people who do not believe there's room for a public sector, who will just as soon destroy the government, and that's what's happened, and do not see the legitimacy in other points of view.
You're actually part of a political family. Your sister's been very, very involved with the Clintons. She worked for the president in his communication office. I think she's supporting Hillary.
She's very close to Hillary, yes.
And let's name her. Her name is Ann Lewis.
Ann Lewis. Uh-huh. I'm sorry, Ann Lewis.
Yes, by the way, she married Gerald Lewis in the 50s and then got divorced, but retained her maiden name. And if you think for a minute, you'll understand why. Her name would have been Anne Frank.
Yeah.
In 1960, it was a little late to go back to being Anne Frank.
Yeah, that would be somewhat of a burden.
I think. You throw people off.
But you haven't always agreed in lockstep with the Clintons, with the president
nope.
or Hillary. When you disagree with the Clintons, how do they tell you that we're not happy with your disagreement, or do they not say anything?
No, in fact,
how do they react to that?
Well, it's one of the things I figured out early on. I mean, he's the president, and he's got more at stake than I do in our disagreements. Look, I think Nancy Pelosi is literally, truly one of the great leaders of our time. And once I disagreed with her on an important issue. It had to do with who should be the majority leader. And I supported the candidate she wasn't for. I was taking over as chairman of the committee. And someone said to me, well, aren't you worried that the speaker will be angry at you? Well, first of all, Nancy's a reasonable person who doesn't carry grudges, although she can be effective. But I said, no, here's what I have learned. I am not afraid of my leader. I am afraid of my followers. When you are in the leading position, you need to be nice to the people who are next in line. So the other thing was this. I never personalized the disagreements with the Clintons, and there was never a time when I wasn't being supportive of them in some ways while disagreeing on some issues. I thought when Bill Clinton said the era of big government is over, he was making a big mistake in sort of joining in the denigration of government. But on the other hand, from 93 on, when the Republicans started to try to discredit them over Whitewater, et cetera, I knew there was nothing there, culminating in my being, I am proud to say, one of the major defenders of the president in the impeachment cases.
Congressman, as a supporter of Hillary for president in 2016, you're probably aware that many of us are not excited, not so-called ready for Hillary. Now, while it seems she can claim the nomination pretty easily, the Koch brothers and their pals are planning to spend $1 billion to accentuate her liabilities. Many reject the dynasty play by either a Bush or a Clinton, and her hawkish positions as Secretary of State weaken her support from the Democratic left and will be marginalized by super hawks like Tom Cotton, the new guy, on the right. How do you see her path to victory?
First, I reject the dynasty argument. Nobody is inheriting anything. If Hillary Clinton and or Jeb Bush are the nominees, it will be because the people who participate in the primaries and caucuses choose that. There's a kind of a denigration of democracy in that. If the majority of the people who vote in Democratic nomination processes pick Hillary Clinton, that's why she'll be the nominee. It's got nothing to do with any dynastic diktat. Secondly, money is one of the reasons why I don't want to see a bitter primary fight on the Democratic side. And thanks to the media today, no contests in America are not bitter, because the media is just determined to sharpen the edges. We need to conserve our money. Finally, on the hawkish issue, well, first of all, domestic policy, as Paul Krugman very carefully documented, our best economic commentator in America today on public affairs, Hillary Clinton was to Barack Obama's left on specifics in 2008, on health care and other things. Yes, she was more hawkish than I would have liked her to be, but so was Barack Obama. In fact, right now, if people said, would you like to be back there? Yeah, just to say to them, no, you were right. Stay out of Iraq. Do not send troops back in there. That is a quagmire that you cannot work on. So I will be urging her to be, to recognize the limitations on the American military. I think she's generally been there. And given all that, I think she is our strongest candidate. Now, people tell me, oh, well, what's going to excite the left to get her? And I will tell you what's going to excite the left, the Republican nominee. We're going to have a situation in which control of the Supreme Court is going to be on the ballot. Whether or not we maintain financial reform, and she's spoken out strongly about maintaining financial reform, whether we do anything about climate change, whether we do anything about keeping health care. I mean, there's no question, whoever the Republican nominee is, whether it's Jeb Bush or any other, he will be the representative of the right. Jeb Bush is already moving in that direction. So I think the contrast between Hillary Clinton and a Republican nominee on every issue that's important to liberals will be clear enough for us to deal with that.
And just a quick follow-up, respectfully, I feel that the Democratic congressional campaign, Senate and House last year, was only focused on the fact that Democrats were not Republicans. And while gerrymandering explains what happens in the House, I don't think that that covers the Senate. And I think there were many voters who felt the Democrats really didn't have a strong message, except we're not Republicans.
Well, first of all, I have no sympathy for people who say that, because there were very real differences. You know, if you're a voter and the fact that there are real differences on the issues doesn't move you, I don't feel guilty for that. The voters have some responsibility here. Secondly, I do think there was this problem. The Republicans were on the ropes over the shutdowns. And I think, sadly, the serious dysfunction of the rollout of health care gave them a momentum from which we never recovered. But as far as campaigning is concerned, no, many Democrats campaigned more specifically on issues. Part of the problem is this. In the sixth year of an eight-year presidency, the out party almost always does very well. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, there were a lot of Democrats who didn't vote last time. I believe they will be coming back next time. Some of it is people do not understand the importance. They had Obama there. They figured, well, okay, he'll be there to veto things. In 2016, there'll be no safety net. If the Republicans win the presidency again on financial reform, on the Supreme Court, if the next president is a Democrat, if it's Hillary Clinton, she will almost certainly be able to appoint Supreme Court justice or justices who will overturn that terrible Citizens United decision, putting money in there. Because that was a 5-4 decision, and it's too recent to have absolute presidential value. Those are the things we'll talk about.
You were chair of the House Banking Committee in 2008 at the height of the financial crisis. You had a bird's eye view of the crisis itself and our government response. A lot of people have said that Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrats really saved the day here. And then you were spearheading some reforms with Chris Dodd, as you referred to earlier. Do you think you were able to get as far as you needed to go, and are you worried about it coming back?
Well, two things. First, in 2008, if we were in charge, we would have done it a little differently, but you have this problem. There's a terrible crisis. Things are falling apart. And people said, well, why did you try to keep the banks going? Because if the banks failed, it would have been the average working person who would have been crushed. The heads of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase would have been just fine if we'd had a crash. They had enough money salted away, but it was the working guy who was living paycheck to paycheck who was most vulnerable.
You weren't worried about Jamie Dimon.
No, he would have been okay. We did most of what we wanted to do in financial reform, and obviously I would have liked to have gone further in other areas of the economy to try and diminish inequality in the positive sense. But I believe that the legislation we adopted, properly administered by people who believe in it, will prevent the kind of irresponsibility that we saw before. On the other hand, if a Republican wins the presidency, sadly, he won't even have to repeal the law, although he has a Republican Congress, he will do that, and people should understand that's at stake. He can simply appoint people who will not exercise any of the powers. You can't make an administrator be good. In 1994, Democrats in Congress, just before we lost control, passed a bill that directed the Federal Reserve to stop subprime loans that shouldn't be made. People forget this. Oh, you liberals wanted those loans made. No, the Democrats kept trying to stop them. Alan Greenspan was chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he said, that's an interference with the free market. I won't use that power. And the Republicans were then in power and backed him up.
Congressman, do you believe that any of the behavior on Wall Street crossed the line into criminality? And do you believe that prosecutions should have resulted that were essentially held back because of the president's call to look forward, not backward?
Yeah, I think they made a mistake. In fact, I would say this by definition. Anywhere, and I said this contemporaneously, our committee, you know, the jurisdiction, we didn't have sort of criminal jurisdiction. We had the forward-looking one. But anywhere that a financial institution was convicted of a crime, then some individual should have been convicted high up because, you know, the Supreme Court may think corporations are people, but we know they're not. And there's no way that a large bank or investment house can have committed a crime without individuals knowingly do that. So I think they did make a mistake by not doing more prosecutions.
Congressman, there's much more in your book. The details on the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I think, are fascinating, and that was a battle that went right down to the brink.
Absolutely.
And there are many other issues that you championed over the years. We need to let you go over to Dominican for your appearance now. But as we wrap up, what is the number one unfinished business item that you didn't get to, and what do you see as your greatest achievement?
Well, I would like to do more affordable rental housing. By the way, you know, you need it in San Francisco and everywhere else. If you're not going to have push people into mortgages they shouldn't have and home ownership, decent affordable rental housing for a variety of income levels, it puts people to work and it provides good shelter. My biggest frustration is that I was not more successful in restraining military spending. The key to improving the quality of life in America, the key to having the resources so we can deal with increasing inequality, is to substantially reduce an overbloated military budget. Yes, we have to be strong, but we have a military expenditure, and it's my one criticism of President Obama. He asked for a $35 billion increase this year. It should have been a $10 billion decrease, leading it to more. So that is my biggest, that's my major policy concern going forward. We have to bring that military budget down to a reasonable level, freeing up resources to deal with other issues at home.
Barney Frank, thanks for joining us today, and I want to recommend your new book called Frank, It's a fascinating look at your political career and your life and times, and also your very personal struggles with sexual orientation and coming out, and I can highly recommend it. Thanks for being here.
That's very kind of you. Thank
you. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me for this special conversation with former Congressman Barney Frank, along with my co-host Larry Strick. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.